From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, an epidemiologist talks about gathering safely this weekend.
Things that you would want to avoid would be sharing food, sharing drinks, like anything that goes in your mouth should not be going in anybody else's mouth, right?
Also, University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel talks plans for on-campus operations this fall.
It won't be a normal semester no matter what, even if we do have students back here in Ann Arbor. But look, it's important that this generation of students gets the opportunity to continue along the pathway of higher education to become college graduates.
And what happens when a mostly white press corps covers a mostly black city?
When you're from the city, you see the stories as a resilience story. You see it as a continued narrative of Detroiters battling through tough situations and always making it through the other side.
Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Mark Schlissel, president of the University of Michigan, talks to us about plans to restart on-campus instruction this fall.
It turns out that many of our upperclassmen remained here in town in the places they rent with their friends. So, we have to look at the way people behave in the real world, and they might even, strangely enough, be safer on campus.
But first, 2020 may seem like a crazy time to take on a new project or venture, but for some of us, especially in Detroit, there may never have been a more important time. This month marked the launch of a new journalism project to cover the city of Detroit in a way that it has not been covered in a very long time, maybe if ever. With us now is Stephen Henderson. You know him as a longtime voice in the region's journalism, including his hosting of Detroit Today on WDET. He's now also the executive editor of a new project called Bridge Detroit. Stephen, longtime listener, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
And also with us is a voice I know you know, Bryce Huffman, a reporter for Bridge Detroit. We are proud to say we knew him when he was Michigan Radio's West Michigan correspondent. Bryce, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Stephen, can we start out by talking about the void in city news coverage that Bridge Detroit is seeking to fill?
Sure. I think there are two voids that we're looking to fill. One is what I would call the void of responsive journalism, journalism that's driven by the people who live and work and exist in the city, identifying for themselves what things are challenging them, what issues they have, what troubles they have, living the civic lives that each of us kind of aspires to live here. Most journalism is driven by the journalists who decide what stories are important and what things they ought to be doing. Bridge Detroit is really convened around the idea of flipping that model on its head and saying, why don't we talk to Detroiters and ask them what is going on in their lives, what issues they need to know more about, and build the newsroom and our work around that. The other void I think that we really fill here is the void of Detroiters themselves telling these stories from the journalism standpoint. And so the newsroom at Bridge Detroit is reflective of the majority population here in the city of Detroit, which is mostly African-American and Latinx. And I don't know that in the 30 years that I've been involved in journalism, I've ever been part of a newsroom that did reflect the population where I was as much as Bridge Detroit does. And so in both of those ways, we are venturing out into somewhat new territory.
You know, the names that we see on the reporting staff include some names who are newer journalists, like you, Bryce, and some people who've been around the city a long time, like Luis. I wondered, Stephen, you spent 30 years in the business, and you've certainly been on hiring committees all those times. What do you have to say about the lack of representation that we've seen in so many newsrooms over time?
You know, as you say, I've been in any number of newsrooms, and I've been in roles in a lot of them where I was in positions to hire people. And we were always talking about diversity. I mean, my entire career in journalism, that has been a major buzzword in newsrooms. We've got to focus on diversity. We've got to have a more diverse staff. We've got to reflect the population wherever it is that we were doing journalism. And And there were a lot of efforts put into that. It has never reached the point that it should have, though. And I think there is something about saying this is the thing instead of just one of the things that we want to focus on that makes it easier to accomplish the goal. I mean, we never hesitated when we started to build the idea of Bridge Detroit to say this will be reflective of the population and we will do what is necessary to find the people to do those roles and make sure that we're making the right kinds of decisions. The other thing I would say that's really important about that is we don't have to compromise on quality or experience or skill in any way to fulfill that mission. If you look at this staff that we have put together, it's rock stars. I mean, these are people who are doing amazing work already where they are and coming to join us. So we didn't come a bit off of that really high standard of quality that I have always employed in my work in order to fulfill that diversity mandate. I think it's a lesson for newsrooms all over the place about how we can accomplish this goal that we have been talking about for 30 years or more.
Bryce, you grew up in Detroit. These twin voids that Stephen's been talking about, how would you say they shape what people understand of the city and its stories?
Well, that's an interesting question. Growing up in the city, and I grew up reading the Freep, and I grew up reading the news, and I grew up, you know, watching news on TV, and it was always weird to me. And I guess I didn't realize this until I got a little bit older and maybe got to high school, but it was like our stories were always being told through the eyes of someone who wasn't from there. All the important Detroit stories were covered through this lens of like, oh, these poor Detroiters, these people need help. And, you know, that's true in some cases and for some stories, but I think a lot of what gets lost in translation is when you're from the city, you see the stories as a resilience story. You see it as a continued narrative of Detroiters battling through tough situations and always making it through the other side. And that's just something you don't really see in the coverage when the person who's telling the story isn't from here.
Stephen, as an editor, can you think of a kind of story that either just goes missed by newspapers and news organizations if they don't have the staff that doesn't reflect the city's population, or maybe a nuance to a story that gets overlooked?
You know, I think it is about the nuance. It is about seeing the story from the perspective of the people who are being written about or whose issues are being written about. You know, already at Bridge Detroit, I think we have some really key examples of that kind of storytelling. We have a photo story up right now that is by Orlando Bailey, who is our engagement director. He grew up in the city and has put up a photo story about the schools that he went to here in the city of Detroit. He went to a lot of different schools. He went out, took pictures of all of them, and has written an essay about the influence that each of those schools had on him and the influence that they had on the sort of trajectory of his life. If you're not from here, I think, of course, that's an impossible story to tell. It's also an impossible thing for somebody who is from here, who's not in the media, to tell that story in the way that a journalist can. And so by hiring journalists who are also from the city of Detroit and have those experiences, I think we make possible a kind of storytelling that we just don't see enough of in other media. It's not that other media doesn't cover schools or community or education as a subject, it's that they're not able to tell the story in the way that somebody who's from here can.
Bryce, if it's not asking you to tip your hand too much, what kind of stories are you looking forward to covering with Bridge Detroit?
I'm really looking forward to answering questions for people who might not already be that engaged in city politics or in city affairs. I know a lot of people in the city personally who always feel that they are left out of the process when decisions get made on a grand scale. And I really just want to tell those stories and help people really feel like they matter to the city.
Are there, you're coming back to Detroit from Grand Rapids, as we mentioned. What are some big differences in the kind of things that you're going to get to report on?
I think in Grand Rapids, and I love this city, it's, you know, been the place where I really started my real journalism career. But the differences you see are Grand Rapids is a city that functions really with the Dutch Christian Reform community like as the priority in a lot of spaces. And in Detroit, a city that's overwhelmingly Black, and, you know, a lot of people live in poverty, you are taking a look at issues from just a completely different lens. So I think the big difference is I'll be doing stories from a community level for people who feel like they've been completely left out. As where in Grand Rapids, you know, I had a few stories about people who might have been left out of the process, but really a lot of those stories were about people who were already civically engaged and already going to city commission meetings and already very active in politics in their community. So I think one of the big differences is I'll just be talking to people who might not be caught up to speed quite as much, but are probably going to be eager to learn and hopefully will become engaged over time.
Guys, thank you very much for being here. We can't wait to see more of what you're doing. We know you're going to make us all better and more informed.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. And we look forward to trying to forge some partnerships with Michigan Radio. That's another big part of Bridge Detroit is collaborative journalism.
Awesome. Stephen Henderson is the executive editor of Bridge Detroit, which is online right now at bridgedetroit.com. We've also been talking with Bryce Huffman, who is a reporter for Bridge Detroit. He's a former Michigan radio guy. You can still hear his podcast, Same, Same, Different. After the break, the state is beginning to relax social distancing. How can we remain safe while reconnecting with family and friends?
What's really going to be key is the monitoring, right? So we need to know, we need to have testing available so that we can know if we start to see an increase in cases in those areas.
That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A much-needed mental health lift is coming this weekend. Governor Whitmer has lifted a ban on small gatherings. If you're in a group of 10 or less, you're good to get together this weekend, but health officials are stressing there's still a pressing need to take precautions to avoid infecting others with COVID-19 and avoid getting infected yourself. We wanted to talk to an epidemiologist before doing anything crazy. Ryan Malosh joins us now. He is an assistant research scientist at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Ryan, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So this is providing a more satisfying option for some people who are desperate for social interaction for the Memorial Day barbecue situation. But just for starters, do you see the governor being in step with the science on this point?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I know that her advisors are all looking very closely at sort of the way that cases have plateaued in the state and sort of thinking about even the distinct types of outbreaks that we're having across the state. So obviously, Southeast Michigan has been hit a lot harder than many other parts of the state. And I think they're taking all of that into consideration.
You've said that Michigan's outbreak looks different than Iowa's, which looks different than Colorado's. Why do these kinds of distinctions matter when we talk about reducing the course of infection?
Yeah, so I think really the difficulty there is the messaging that goes behind it. So telling people what's safe is going to be very local depending on what's happening at the local level. Mm-hmm. So if you have higher levels of circulation in your area, you're going to want to take extra precautions. But that's hard to convey from a state as big as ours and as diverse as our outbreaks have been. That's a very hard message to convey, I think.
What does the research suggest will help lower risks once the stay-at-home orders are relaxed and people can get together.
Yeah, so I think the research suggests mostly that being in an enclosed space in a large group of people with people who are sick is going to be the highest risk thing. We've seen that a lot through studies of household transmission, where the secondary infection risk for household members is much higher than it is for contacts that you would have out in the general public. And so those types of things tell us that it's really spreading easily in these enclosed spaces with prolonged contact. If that's the highest risk thing, the reverse of that would be the least risky thing. Staying far away from each other as we can. We know that wearing masks does seem to help at least a little bit, particularly if a person who is ill is wearing a mask. But I think it can provide some benefit for everybody. And then, you know, things like taking extra precautions, like washing our hands more, not sharing food, those types of things are all going to reduce our likelihood of being infected, given the fact that we're now able to be in contact with other people again.
Well, let's just talk this through. If you were invited to, say, a neighbor's house this weekend for a cookout and you were otherwise healthy, what kinds of things feel like they would be reasonable risks to take and what kinds of things would you want to avoid?
Yeah, so I would say things that you would want to avoid for sure would be sharing food, certainly, sharing drinks, like anything that goes in your mouth should not be going in anybody else's mouth. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of things that are going to be the highest risk activities. It's a little bit tricky. I think being indoors with somebody who's sick is going to be also high risk. So if you're sick or if someone that is invited to the gathering is sick or has been around somebody who's sick in the last couple of days, they should stay home. That's going to be one of the best ways, I think, that we can really protect ourselves, protect the people around us who we don't want to spread the disease onto, is to take, you know, some additional responsibility to know that if we are sick, we're going to limit our interactions with other people so that we don't spread it on.
I know that you have a family at home. This has to be terribly difficult as a parent, knowing the risks as an epidemiologist and talking to kids who just want to know when playdates are going to be a normal thing again.
Yeah, our kids definitely are itching. They're getting sick of each other, I'm sure, sick of us as well. Would love to get back with friends. And my daughter's in kindergarten. She would love to go back to school. But, you know, I think the hard thing is to convey the tips that we have about reducing harm to a child. So it's really hard to convince your four-year-old, your six-year-old to stay 6 feet away from their friend. The first thing they want to do when they see them is give them a hug. So those are the kinds of things that as adults, we maybe have to take some extra precautions with setting up play dates and go through the guidelines, to go through the rules in advance. These is the kind of playing that's okay, and this is the kind of playing that we maybe shouldn't be doing.
To that end, I mean, nobody has a crystal ball right now, but how do you see the reopening of school unfolding with small kids when they don't really get what social distancing means?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there are some people that are thinking about this very carefully. I know some of the districts in Michigan are trying to put out their plans, and I think there'll be good public feedback about those, and hopefully we can come up with a consensus. But I don't think we know enough about what happens in kids yet to make a clear decision around this. The evidence just isn't there because most of the infection has been happening in adults, or at least the infections that we've been able to document through testing, because those are the people who are having severe disease. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we know enough about kids to really make a clear decision, an evidence-based decision about school reopenings yet. But I do think some of the things that we're thinking about, like staggering the days that kids are coming to schools and giving a day in between to disinfect surfaces, I think is all smart and sort of common sense types of approaches. And hopefully we can figure out in the coming months how to get kids back to school safely.
You are a survivor of a bout with leukemia from a few years back. Your vulnerability to viral conditions must also give you a pretty unique perspective on all this. What are the risk calculations that you're making as someone who's in a high-risk group?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed in November of 2018. with leukemia, and I underwent a bone marrow transplant. Shout out to my brother for donating the stem cells that saved my life in March of last year. So I'm a little bit more than a year out, and the year mark is typically when they sort of release most of your restrictions as a bone marrow transplant survivor. So the risk of infection goes down pretty substantially at that point. I'm no longer on immunosuppressive drugs. But I was set to go back to the office on March 9th, and obviously that didn't happen. And so my calculation is a lot different than most people's. And I'm used to sort of thinking about what would happen if I got an infection. I mean, I've gotten very mild infections, things that most people wouldn't even notice, in the last year that put me in the hospital for 5 or 6 days. And so I take extra precautions. You know, if I'm going to go out someplace where I know that there's a chance somebody will be sick around me, I'll wear a mask. I try to avoid going out as much as I can. I've been doing that for over a year now. My wife does all the grocery shopping, you know, any runs to the store that have to be done. She does that. And then, you know, we take extra precautions when she comes home. She washes her hands. We've been washing our hands, you know, extra and disinfecting the house more often than we typically would have because of this. So yeah, I'm a little bit used to it, but I think everybody is gonna have to sort of come around to that sort of thinking as we reemerge from our isolation here.
What do all these conversations about reopening, I mean, does this even mean anything to you as someone who's immunocompromised?
It means something to me in terms of, you know, being able to see my close family who I was, you know, in contact with before. And they, again, you know, they were taking precautions to protect me. That's just kind of the life that we've had to lead for the last year. And it'll be nice to see, you know, extended family again and things like that. I think, because my risk, you know, among the high risk people, I'm relatively healthy. I don't look sick anymore. I don't feel sick anymore. My numbers are all coming back good. I think, you know, I was starting to get around to the idea of taking on a little bit more risk on my own. So in that sense, you know, reopening does provide some opportunities for me to get back some of the social aspects of life that I've been missing for a while. So yeah, it means a lot to me.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with epidemiologist and cancer survivor Ryan Milosh. We're talking about the different levels of risk people are exposing themselves to as the Michigan economy starts to reopen. The situation in every state is so different, and really so different even among cities in a state like Michigan. Up north has not been hit as hard as Metro Detroit. We also know that bars and restaurants up north are being allowed to reopen at 50% capacity. What's on your mind in terms of the epidemiology of this as folks in popular vacation spots are getting ready for what they fear might be a surge of visitors?
Yeah, so I think what's really going to be key is the monitoring. So we need to know, we need to have testing available so that we can know if we start to see an increase in cases in those areas. We know we've learned a lot, and we don't know everything about this disease yet, but we've learned a lot in the last couple of months. And one of the things we know is that there's a typical lag. So from infection to symptom onset, it's about 5 or 6 days, you know, another week or so before people start presenting at hospitals with severe symptoms. And so we need to be really proactively monitoring those areas at the appropriate time from when they've reopened to sort of see if increases are happening, and then be ready to, hopefully this doesn't happen, but if cases are, or if there's indications that it is spreading more readily up there, then we'll have to, you know, think about scaling back how we've reopened, I think.
Ryan, I heard you grew up in Gladwin. Can I ask you about what's going on in Midland right now?
Yeah, I think this is just such a tough situation that's happening in Midland. I grew up from, my parents owned a cottage on the Tittabawassee River when I was in high school. I grew up in Gladwin. I spent the first 18 years of my life there. And, you know, my heart really goes out to everybody that's been affected by the flooding. And
do you know anyone who had to evacuate?
So I don't know anybody who had to evacuate to a shelter, which I think is, you know, sort of the thing that you worry most about right now. With COVID-19, you know, it's not circulating at high levels, but there are cases up there. And so putting in people into a congregate setting, like we talked about, in an enclosed space where there's a lot of people, that's sort of the riskiest thing we can think about. But I don't know anybody that had to go into that situation. I do know several people who's had to go stay with family members in neighboring communities. And I know a good friend who works at Midland Hospital who was up all night helping evacuate the hospital there. It's really almost a worst case scenario that as to, you know, a natural disaster like that happening during a global pandemic. It's really scary.
It's a lot. When people are forced to be in contact in a disaster situation, when they've had to evacuate, are there things that can be done to minimize risk?
Absolutely. So these are the things that we've all heard about. But I think there's one key that maybe doesn't get conveyed as well in the messaging. And so, you know, things like hand washing and wearing a mask and staying at least 6 feet away from people, although, you know, the further the better. All of those things can really help, but they're not perfect interventions, right? And so I think stacking multiple interventions on top of each other, I kind of like the Swiss cheese analogy, right? So you've got each intervention is a slice of Swiss cheese. It's got holes in it. The virus can get through in certain ways. But if you stack those layers of Swiss cheese up, the holes will eventually all be covered. And so I think
within the package, right? Okay.
Yeah, like in the package. And then eventually, you know, you'll be blocking a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And you can sort of, hopefully, I don't think we're ever going to reduce risk down to zero with these types of interventions, but we can significantly reduce the risk of transmission if we use multiple interventions. And I mean things like temperature screening, you know, as if people are entering a shelter, for example, asking screening questions about have they been in contact with sick people, do they have symptoms themselves, those types of things. We just layer those interventions one on top of the other, and we can really hopefully interrupt the transmission.
This has got to be such a strange time to be an epidemiologist. Do you feel like there are things being learned in the field that we might not otherwise have a chance to witness firsthand?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that we're learning about how we communicate our research, right? And ways that we maybe haven't been as good at doing that in the past. And sort of the limits of rapidly conducting research and rapidly disseminating the results of that research. I think we're all learning sort of, and I think, you know, in a couple of months or years, we'll be able to look back and say, these are the mistakes that were made and how we can do better about that in the future.
I'm curious, do you and your family have plans for the weekend?
We don't. So we actually, we live next door to my in-laws. I'm kind of surrounded, actually. They're buying the house on the other side of us as well. So I'm sure we'll have, you know, we'll share a meal with them now that we're sort of able to do that kind of stuff. And maybe we'll see my parents as well, who live a little bit further away. But we don't have any major plans. We're still going to be practicing social distancing because I am at high risk. So we're going to be probably maintaining that for the foreseeable future.
You know, so many people are really afraid right now. What do you tell them when you hear people saying that they're just kind of paralyzed by what's going on?
That is a really tough thing. I mean, I think that the way to sort of, I don't know, reduce people's fear is through information. And so through honest communication about what we know and what we don't know. and what we can, what the science tells us we can expect. I think, you know, there's been challenges with that, and I don't think that we've always done it perfectly, or sometimes not even very well. But I think, trying to be honest about what we don't know as well as what we do know, is probably the best way to help reduce people's fears.
Ryan Malash, PhD, is an assistant research scientist at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Ryan, thank you so much for talking to us, and we wish you a safe weekend.
Thank you very much. You guys be safe, too.
We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind. Send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is Stateside Radio. In other news, colleges and universities are making very tough choices as they plan for the future. In a moment, U of M President Mark Schlissel is our guest. That's after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Among the many unanswered questions for Michigan's economy is the future of higher education in the state. A number of schools have announced plans to resume classes this fall, some with in-person instruction, many with online instruction, and some with a mix of both. Right out in front of all of this is the University of Michigan, the state's biggest player in higher ed. Mark Schlissel is the president of the University of Michigan, and he joins us today. President Schlissel, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks, April. It's really very nice to be here.
At what point did you know that not only this spring would be very different, but also the fall?
Pandemic hit the radar screen very early in the new calendar year for me, but I didn't really appreciate its seriousness until late February, I'd say mid to late February. And it was the middle of March when we realized that we had to convert our educational programs to remote. And then after the governor's order closed down our lab. So I'd say it's early in the year, but it got progressively more and more serious, of course.
There's so much here to talk about, both in terms of Michigan medicine and the university's graduate and undergraduate programs. But I just wanted to ask about your personal take on this. First of all, you're an immunologist by training. How has that informed any personal or professional decisions that you've made over the past couple of months?
Yeah, you know, that's a bit of serendipity. So I'm a physician scientist. I have an MD and a PhD from Johns Hopkins. And my own laboratory research has been studying the immune system, and even more specifically, the part of the immune system that responds to infection making antibodies. So this is really very much inside of my research expertise and within my clinical expertise. So it's helped a tremendous amount. It's really helped me integrate and have my own judgment about lots of high-quality advice that I'm getting from our outstanding physicians in the health system and our great School of Public Health and their epidemiologists, our chief health officer, Preeti Malani, and others. So because it's close enough to my areas of expertise, I can really add value in addition to just integrating the advice of other experts. So it's serendipitous but valuable.
The university's plan at the moment is that there will be at least some in-person operation and instruction going on this fall. Do you think that students at all the levels will pay for a mix of in-person and online classes?
Well, you know, I think you may have overstated the current circumstance. What I've said publicly and what is certainly true is that I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll be able to have a public health-informed in-person semester. Whether that can come to pass is going to depend on things that are partly outside of my control. So if Michigan, for example, suffers a second wave of infection of this virus and the frequency is going up and our health systems are once again crowded with COVID-19 patients, And we're going to have to be adaptable and continue instruction remotely, like we are this spring and summer, for example. But we're also planning and hoping that we'll be able to mitigate enough of the risk that we can bring students back to campus and have this public health informed experience. So what that means is, to the extent possible, avoiding large gatherings, asking people to wear masks, social distancing, the deployment of testing for the virus to make sure we know who's infected and we can quarantine them, and to use the public health toolbox and the best advice we can get to capture the essence of an in-person education, but while minimizing the risk, not just for our students, but for our faculty and staff.
There was an op-ed that appeared in The Atlantic this month by Michael Sorrell, who's a former president of a college in Dallas. And in it, he talked about his view that colleges and universities are deluding themselves if they think that they can reopen safely. He was citing a working paper from researchers at Cornell. We'll post the link on our social feeds if people want to have a read on this. But I wonder, do you think that he's overstating the case?
He's stating an opinion, certainly. And look, in reality, what is influencing me is the fact that COVID-19 is not going away. So it'll be with us until we either develop and deploy a vaccine. And the whole optimism around vaccines, I think it is great to be optimistic. But think of the challenge of developing a vaccine in a matter of months, which has never been done before, testing it to make sure that it's safe and effective. And the safe part's enormously important because you're giving it to healthy people. You know, these people should be exposed to no risk from getting a vaccine. And then deploying it to 300 million people in two doses. So to me, even under the best of circumstances, we won't have a vaccinated population until a year from now at the very earliest. So I think to be prudent, we have to plan to live with the virus, to coexist with the virus. And we can use, as I said, the best advice we get from public health principals and from medical colleagues. And hopefully now that the testing challenges have been or are being sorted out, to help us coexist. This isn't something that's going away in a few months. So, for example, if we don't have an on-campus experience in September, what's going to be different in January? Nothing's going to be different. As a matter of fact, it'll be riskier in January because it'll be influenza season. Mm-hmm. And the symptoms overlap, so it'll be hard to distinguish the two without testing. So we are engaged in a thoughtful exercise to figure out what's the safest way forward. And you also have to recognize that our students are also exposed to risk living at home. And they're unlikely to stay in their homes. They're going to be out and about to some limited extent, at least. You know, you see pictures from around the country of people socializing in the states that have lifted their stay-at-home kind of orders.
Well, and we have seen, you know, we've
seeking behaviors.
We've all seen the videos and pictures from bars in Ann Arbor and also in East Lansing that were packed with students despite warnings in the early stages. I mean, young people who are coming to college are adults, but they're also young people who are making their own decisions for maybe the first
reason
time
I
in life.
The reason I bring that up, April, is what we're comparing is the risk to these young people at home and the risk to these young people here in Ann Arbor. And if we can get the risk here in Ann Arbor down to be as low as the risk when they're at home anyway, then we can conduct a fall semester. So if you think they're at home, not going out with their friends and not seeing others and not engaging in social behavior, well, then I guess, you know, there's no way to get the risk as low as somebody staying home in mom's basement. But that's not really what's happening. Even our students here in Ann Arbor, when we sent everybody home to do remote instruction, it turns out that many of our upperclassmen remained here in town in the places they rent with their friends. So, you know, we have to look at the way people behave in the real world, and they might even, strangely enough, be safer on campus because they'll be subject to our influence, at least in part. And they would use personal protective devices like masks. They would have temperature screening. You know, we would have the capacity to provide a quarantine for people who get ill. But look, this isn't a sure thing yet, and we're still thinking hard about that balance between risk and the advantages and disadvantages of in-person versus remote education.
How do you imagine teaching load might change if in-person instruction can be held? And if it's going to need to be done in a socially distant manner, it sounds like some things might have to change about who's carrying the bulk of the day in and day out work of lecturing.
Well, I think what we'll do is the larger courses that are currently delivered in a lecture format, we would deliver remotely, regardless of whether the students were back here in Ann Arbor or whether they were at home. And the smaller classes that involve discussions, teaching laboratories, clinical instruction for nurses, for dental students, for medical students, things that are very difficult to replace online, we'll do in person. So it won't be a normal semester no matter what, even if we do have students back here in Ann Arbor. But it's important that this generation of students gets the opportunity to continue along the pathway of higher education to become college graduates. And, it's more important now than ever in a knowledge economy and with all of the economic insecurity that existed before the pandemic and now certainly with the pandemic. People that complete their education certainly have a leg up, and we'd like to provide that opportunity for as many people as possible.
What's going to happen with the university's research functions and labs? Will they be continuing?
Yeah, of course. So it turns out, and perhaps coincidentally, that the governor lifted her order limiting laboratory research. So that was lifted as of Monday of this current week that we're in. And as of yesterday, we've begun slowly and carefully to reactivate our research labs. We're the largest public research university in the country with literally thousands of researchers and $1.6 billion a year of research activity. So we're finally able to get those labs back up again cautiously. So all of this is a matter of living with the virus while we get back to doing the mission of the university.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Mark Schlissel, the president of the University of Michigan. I just read that the NCAA will allow voluntary activities for football and basketball to resume as of June 1st. What's the conversation among the Big Ten schools with the NCAA about crowdless football?
First of all, the NCAA as an organization, we're certainly a member, says what you're allowed to do. It doesn't say what you must do. And the Big Ten itself has yet to make a decision about resuming training and other sports activities. So that decision is still pending. The Big Ten presidents, the 14 Big Ten presidents, get together virtually on a pretty regular basis with Kevin Warren, who's the relatively new Big Ten commissioner. And this is just the kind of issue we discuss. As we think about athletics in the fall, if we are fully remote in the fall, if we can't find a safe way to bring students back to campus, we won't bring student athletes back to campus. So there won't be organized sports unless we can have an in-person semester. It just doesn't make sense to me to bring student athletes to campus when we're not allowing every other student to be on campus to pursue their education. So that's yet to be determined. And then I do have concerns about safety issues, and it's hard to imagine. The Big House is 110,000 seats, of course, bigger than the stadium in that place down south that we were talking about earlier. To imagine bringing 100,000 people in to watch a football game during an active pandemic, it's just very hard to imagine. Sure. But I could imagine at the scale of our student athletes, if they wish to play and if the league wants to play, I could imagine testing every single student athlete, every single coach, all the referees, the media. And I could certainly imagine a way with an acceptable level of safety to play a game in front of media and TV, but not in front of 100,000 people.
Yeah. Before COVID-19 struck, higher education was experiencing some big problems. Student debt has been widely discussed, and the whole funding model. There have been a number of small private liberal arts schools that have failed over the past 5 years, sort of accelerating, the questions about what's going on in higher ed. I mean, I know the University of Michigan is not at risk in that way, but do you think that there's any way that this time could be used to address some of the elephants in the room?
Well, I think we should always be under pressure to deliver the highest value education at a cost that's commensurate with its value that people can afford. In terms of public higher education, you know, unfortunately, we're still in the midst of a many decades long disinvestment by the public in public higher ed. So we're living in an era where people don't seem to believe as much how important it is to invest in common goods. So they want folks to pay their own way as opposed to everybody chipping in a little bit. So as the state's support of the university has gone down through the decades, we've had to charge more money to individuals. But what we try to do, and we've been very successful at it within the state of Michigan, is to provide need-based financial aid so that everybody in the state, regardless of their family's income, can afford a University of Michigan education. We call that the Go Blue Guarantee that you may have read about, and it means we provide financial aid to cover at least full tuition for students that come from families at or below $65,000 of family income, which is the median income in the state. And we provide need-based aid all the way to families making well over $100,000 a year. So what we've done is we've adjusted to the lack of state support by filling in the gaps with need-based financial aid.
What can you tell us about how out-of-state enrollment looks for the fall with the current uncertainty? I imagine a great deal of what Michigan is able to do is based on the degree to which students from out-of-state are willing to come and play their part in the financial equation.
Well, I think we've benefited as a university by being very much a national public university. Always more than half of our students come from Michigan, but we're attractive to students from all around the country and all around the world. So far, you know, our enrollment for the fall semester coming up is right on target. The out-of-state students are saying, yes, thank you, we'd love to come to Ann Arbor with the same frequency they usually do, as same with the in-state students. So we're cautiously optimistic, you know, we'll continue to keep our target. What happens over the summer months all the time is something called summer melt in the profession, where students who said they were coming to school changed their mind. And we're very worried about that across the summer with so much uncertainty and people not knowing what's going to happen with this disease and whether there will be second waves at various places around the country or even here in Michigan. So enrollment's at risk, but right now we're fully enrolled as best we can tell for the fall semester.
Yeah. Is there anything about what's happened over the course of the pandemic that you feel like has deepened the university's mission in any way?
Well, I'd say one or two things. One is, if you think about this epidemic, it is an advertisement for why our nation's investment in basic biomedical research has been critical. So we were able to go from a brand new description of a disease to the virus that causes it, to the sequence of its genome, to a PCR test to very sensitively detect the virus, and now to test to detect antibodies against the virus, all in a matter of weeks or months. Imagine what it would have been like to try to confront this new illness, never before seen in human illness, without the tools and the trained scientists that we've spent decades investing in. So that's one very important feature. The other thing is, I don't think the public in general recognizes the way that our healthcare community stepped up to this challenge. So Michigan Medicine, but every other hospital, basically stopped doing routine clinical care and completely reoriented their capacity to take care of people with a new scary infectious disease. And they did it remarkably well. So in our own hospital, it's had enormous consequences. It's had adverse budgetary consequences because we stopped filling the hospital with regular patients and kept the capacity available for COVID-19 patients. We closed down our outpatient clinics. Their volume went down 95%. So at great personal financial sacrifice, the health system did the right thing. They dropped everything and they took care of an emergency. So I'm forever grateful and respectful of the physicians and the nurses and all the technical and support staff that without a moment's hesitation stepped in there and dealt with this once in a generation emergency.
President Schlissel, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
It's a real pleasure, April. Thanks very much for your interest and your time.
Mark Schlissel is the president of the University of Michigan. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. You have a safe weekend, and we'll catch you next week.
Thank you.